It's a smaller knit group because I'm trying to build relationships between people, not just, again, have somebody down for a weekend to shoot a deer and everybody celebrate and go home. You watch them grow and you watch them grow and you watch them grow. And then about 3 weeks before the season, they just stop. They just stop coming out. And I'm not kidding. It was probably less than 10 minutes before you hear, and you just hear, they say, well, you know, can you eat that? And I'm like, absolutely. I thought the same way until I tried one and they're absolutely delicious. The most important thing is your attitude. If you're not having fun and showing that you're not having fun, the person that's with you is not going to be having fun. This is Jamie Shara with the Hunter Recruitment Project, and you're listening to The Wild Initiative.
Put down your latte and pull on your boots.
I would rest at peace for eternity if my legacy was that I made a positive influence on the non-hunting public about what hunters are and what hunting is.
I finally got my buck on our last real day of hunting.
So a pro-hunting organization is voting against hunting. And that says anti-hunting to me.
There was a year straight where I was averaging up to 200 death threats a day.
I hugged it. Like, I just wanted to hug a bear.
It's proven that the average steak in a grocery store touches 50 to 100 hands and machines. And we're putting that into our body.
Hey, y'all. Cable Smith, host of the Lone Star Outdoors Show here.
This is Adam Weatherby.
I'm Corey Jacobson with Elk 101.
This is Christy Titus.
Hey, folks. This is John Bear.
You're listening to The Wild Initiative.
Hey, y'all, welcome to another episode of The Wild Initiative, brought to you as part of the Waypoint Outdoor Collective. All right, y'all, today on the podcast, I have the one and only Jamie Shira, straight out of Georgia, here to talk a little bit about hunter recruitment and the Hunter Recruitment Project. We're going to have a good chat and see where it takes us. Thanks for hopping on, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's a kind of a short notice here. So I was really, really glad I had the gap in the schedule to put it all together.
Yeah, it was great. Baker's like, hey man, I got all these great people that I want to introduce you to. And I was like, well, I got this opening Wednesday morning. If you know anyone, he's like, oh, like 3 seconds later, he shot me your name. So I'm like, all right, hey, all right.
Right place, right time.
Like, we've hunted together on multiple continents and he's a good guy and he'll talk your ear off. So just the kind of guest I need.
Yeah. We've spent a lot of time in the woods together. And we've hunted in Africa, South America, and in North America. So it's been a lot of travel with us.
That's awesome, man. That's awesome. So I always like to kick things off with just kind of an introduction of who you are, but especially how did you get introduced to the outdoors? Like, yep. what got you into hunting and all this?
Yeah. So give you a little background. I grew up in South Georgia on a commercial quail plantation. My grandfather was a big time wild quail hunter. My dad as well. My dad actually thought he was Davy Crockett for a while. And literally, like, I think at one point when he was 11 or 12, left the house for like 10 days or something and no one knew where he was. I didn't have phones or anything back then, and came back and he had just literally left with his shotgun and his traditional bow and went out in the woods, and I don't think he had any success. I think it was like during the summer too, so it was pretty terrible timing and wasn't a lot of forethought from a 11 or 12 year old. But he lived it, man. He wore moccasins out in the woods. He absolutely loved it. And that's where I got, my love for the outdoors from. I was, my dad was put on babysitting duty, and that was taking us to the deer stand as we were very little children, like in a stroller still. I think I was a year and a half when I went on my first deer hunt. I killed my first deer when I was 6 years old, 6-pointer. I remember I was dead asleep in the stand. And my dad woke me up and he already had the rifle laid across his lap, kind of pointing away from me, kind of facing towards the deer. And he gave me a little elbow nudge and, hey, wake up, there's a deer. He's like, don't move, but there's a deer. And there's a 6-pointer probably like 85 yards away. And literally I kind of like woke up, picked my head up. It's like, oh, God, I see him. Like, put my hand right on the rifle. I think I moved it like, 6 inches, took a shot, deer fell over backwards. And it was like, that was it. I was dialed. But yeah, I grew up same. We camped all over the U.S. We that's what we did. If you were watching football or it wasn't a holiday, you were either hunting or you were getting ready to hunt, prepping the woods, putting up stands, planting food plots, et cetera, et cetera. But when I graduated high school, I went to University of Georgia, go Dogs. And that it's about four hours away from where I grew up. And to get a little tangent here, I lost Hope Scholarship, which in Georgia pays for your education. And when I went to school, it paid for everything except for housing. So it paid for all books, tuition, et cetera. And so I called my dad. I was like, hey, lost Hope, what am I going to do? And he's like, well, I mean, it sounds like you either need to get a job to pay for school or you can come home and work. And
so either way, basically get a job.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Get a job, you bum. And I knew at that point in my life, I was, obviously rebellious 18, 19 year old. I wasn't going to go home. That was just not an option for me. So got a job working in a bar. That was a full-time job, even only working 3 or 4 days. I started managing and, all holidays, every weekend I worked and really got away from any type of outdoor activity. I was making good money, and making good money was fun. And for 4 or 5 years, I really kind of stayed away from the outdoors. And I moved to Atlanta after school, opened up our first restaurant here. And I'm still in that industry. That's the primary industry that I'm in, is restaurant and bar industry. And about 5 Christmases ago, I think it was, I'd spend more and more time going home and just hanging out with my family. I missed a lot of family time for like 8 or 9 years just working. And so just hanging out with my parents, you notice they're getting older. I'm getting older. Priorities start to change a little bit. And I don't know what I was doing. I think, it was kind of like the rise of when Instagram and hunting really started to kind of take foot. And so I'm starting to see all this stuff on social media. And I just kind of like lit a little fire. And I really didn't have a lot of interest in deer hunting with a rifle anymore for big bucks, because I'd done it. And, I'd never killed a monster buck, but I'd killed a lot of 140, 150 inch, 10 pointers, 11, 12, eights, really good deer. I'm a pretty decent shot. So, I could literally get in a pine tree 100 feet up in the air in a climbing stand and see a mile. And, it just wasn't really that much of a sport for me. But I had gotten into fishing a lot. Turkey hunting was always still there. So I still always made time in the spring to go home for turkey hunting. That was kind of a special thing me and my dad had. My brother doesn't care about turkey hunting. No one else I knew really turkey hunting. My dad was just, that was his deal. So it's kind of my deal. But I bought a bow about, like I said, 5 or 6 years ago. And I'd had a bow in high school. My brother actually took it to college with him and sold it for money when he was in college. And, yeah, I love brothers. And I buy a bow and I get it all set up, get everything right. I practiced a lot. What I thought was a lot was not a whole lot. I'm sitting in the deer stand the first night with the bow. First afternoon, it's Thanksgiving, and probably 150 inch 10 pointer walks 15 yards from me, but it was just dark enough and I didn't have luminescent pins. And I just couldn't see anything. And I had not felt that excitement. And I spent a ton of time scouting the stand, getting my cameras out in the woods, just trying to get everything out. And it lit a fire in me that is only gotten apparently hotter and brighter in the last 4 or 5 years. But that lit me on fire. So that whole Christmas, I was at home, I was hunting and had shot a lot more. And I actually spot and stalked maybe the same deer. I can't be sure, but I'm fairly certain it was the same deer. And I got within about 40 yards. And spot and stalking whitetails is kind of a crazy thing. And so especially in South Georgia, they're like super turned on, super crazy animals. And so I raise up, I draw, And as soon as I let go, you know, he string jumps me, and at 40 yards, mature deers, they're going to get moving. And I shot completely over his back, and that was it. I mean, that attempt kind of locked me in. And so, long story short, it's kind of been in my blood my whole life. It's something I've always done. I mean, I remember like when I was a little kid, our job was to clean out the dog kennels, right? So we had 45 to 55 bird dogs at any time. And so we cleaned up a lot of poop, and that was our like contribution to the family business. So, you know, we were in it.
Awesome. So now then, how did you and Baker meet? Cause that then takes us into the hunter recruitment project.
So there's a company, a beverage company, which some people may have heard of, called Killcliff. And Killcliff is a post workout recovery drink. And they've now gotten big into the CBD business. Joe Rogan has a flavor with them. So I helped start that company back in 2011, I think, is when I came on. And so in the beginning, it was Todd, the founder. It was me, Baker, a guy named GW, a guy named Michael, who also is in with the Hunter Recruitment Project, and two or three other people. Super small company. Baker was the guy that was out on the road. I think he drove across the country three times in 1 year. Like he went like south, like middle, and then north, like back and forth across the country. And I got somehow handed the operations director job. And I was 23 or four. I didn't even know what that meant at the time. But my job was to make sure Baker had all the stuff that he needed to be successful at all these events he was going to. And there was like all these little CrossFit events all over the US. And I think he was at like half of them in 1 year. And my job was to make sure I shipped stuff ahead of time to these gyms, like t-shirts and all that. And then all of a sudden I was having to do production and all this. So Baker and I worked hand in hand for like 4 years. I mean, like talked every day on the phone. And it was very similar to the relationship I have with my brother, and the fact that, you know, we just kind of rode each other's ass nonstop about everything all the time. And it just became really good friends. And obviously, you know, I would take him hunting. We would go hunting. We went 1 year, we went hunting, bird hunting in South America. And that kind of, you know, was really the impetus to us hunting a lot. He had hunted a little bit when he grew up, but didn't have the same kind of background that I did in hunting. And so there was a lot of stuff I was kind of helping teach him, and it was a really cool experience for both of us, I think.
So then how does that turn into the Hunter Recruitment Project? And tell us a little bit about what that is and the idea behind it.
Yeah. Yeah. So the Hunter Recruitment Project is simply as stated. It's a project that we started to recruit hunters into you know, this world. One thing that's a little bit different, or a couple things that's a little bit different. We focus on adults. There's a lot of different programs for kids out there. My thought in focusing on adults is that a kid, we can take him hunting one time, but they don't really have the wherewithal, the ability to make decisions to go back. They don't have income, they don't have jobs, or you know, they're kids, right? And so, how can I latch, you know, my wagon to someone who has the ability, has the desire, has the financial wherewithal to go hunting and to get out there and have the time off to go do these things. Two, we really focus on an immersive weekend. So it's not come down, wake up, we go sit and stand, you shoot a deer, high five, see you later. We're creating mentor-mentee relationships. So you're paired with a mentor, sometimes multiple. Everybody's on the same email thread. Everybody's on the same text thread. It's a smaller knit group because I'm trying to build relationships between people, not just, again, have somebody down for a weekend to shoot a deer and everybody celebrate and go home. The last thing is that there's a lot of additional educational components. So, you know, we've had SEAL snipers teaching people how to shoot. We've had showing people how to hang stands, how to properly hang stands safely. We've done, you know, some outdoor survival skill stuff. We've had Green Beret that's a medic come and teach people, you know, how to take care of someone in the incident that you have, traumatic incident out in the outdoors. So there's a whole lot of other hands-on educational components that isn't, again, just kind of hunt camp, hanging out, you know, skinning deer, processing deer, all those things.
That's awesome. So, is this something that you guys actively are looking for people? Or you like reach out to them? Do people find it and apply? Like, what's the whole experience for someone coming out?
Yeah. So right now, it's by, nomination. So we invited an original group of people and each one of them are nominating someone to come. And that's the way that we're building it again, because it's really focused on relationships. And so we're trying to create a network of people that are all, you know, that are just once removed from the group before. They're once removed. Part of that's by design. Part of that's also because of resources, right? There's only a couple of us, and there's limited amount of weekends. And so in the next couple of years, figuring out how to scale that into additional states with additional camps with additional people is going to be the way that we grow this mission even further. And at that point it would be application based. But I always say this too, anybody that wants to take someone hunting, you know, you're part of the hunter recruitment project. I mean, at the end of the day, like there's no, you know, there might not be a title. We've got a guy that works for a company, I met through a company called Sorenex, Taylor Quick. He lives in Mississippi. He takes people every year. He just reached out. I met him at an event like 2 years ago. He reached out. I was like, hey man, I really love what you guys are doing. I've been taking people hunting, you know, let me know if I can help in any way. Right. And I'm like, dude, just keep doing what you're doing. Tag us in your post. Like, you know, let's keep this thing going. Let's show other people kind of how we do this thing. I know for me, and I'm sure it's the same most everywhere. And I think you kind of said it at the beginning, and I also read on your website, when you're getting into this hunting ordeal, I mean, it's a huge undertaking. And unfortunately there's a lot of people out there that are not interested in getting people into the sport because it takes resources away from them. Which in my opinion is a scarcity mindset. You know, we've got so much opportunity in the US and there's so many avenues in which people can hunt and be successful in hunting. And, you know, the more money we have in the sport, the more money we have for conservation, the more opportunity we have in the future. I mean, it's kind of a linear thing to me. So I don't understand why we wouldn't want to get more people into hunting, but you know, at the end of the day, it's kind of something that's always been a part of the way I grew up. My dad always took people hunting. We had, you know, programs for kids at our school that could come out to the farm and, you know, teach them how to shoot a gun, teach them how to skin a rabbit, teach them how to shoot clays, teach them, you know, just very basic, you know, outdoor stuff. And so for me, it's kind of been a calling and I was taking people hunting a couple of years ago and Baker and I were having people reach out, you know, just kind of out of the blue. Hey man, I was, you know, saw you here. You know, what kind of bow do you use? I'd like to get into bow hunting. What do you, you know, what camo, why this, why that? And I started realizing like all these questions are from people that actually don't hunt at all. Mm-hmm. And so, let me not only take a lot of time and attention with these people and actually answer their questions thoroughly and say, hey, you know, you got a second to jump on the phone or here's eight links or here's a great article from, you know, whatever, here's Dudley School of Knock. I think I've sent that thing out like 40 times to people that are trying to get into bow hunting. I'm like, follow this 12 week program. You will be able to shoot a bow accurately if you follow it to the T. I still do it to this day. And so, you know, as it just developed, I don't honestly remember the exact kind of inception point, but we both were sitting there. We're like, hey man, like, I think this is, I was really searching for, what can my value add be to the outdoor network? Right. I have full-time job. I'm kind of sucked into that whole world. How do I add value to the brands and the companies that are, you know, being in conservation and how do I add value back to them? And my only thought is, hey, put more people in the woods.
I get so frustrated because, I mean, you touched on it. There's so many people out there with that scarcity mindset and that, you know, they're just like, we're going down with the ship. You know, we're going to, it drives me nuts because those are then also the same people that are posting the most offensive things. They're driving people away from hunting. And it kills me on a daily basis. And I understand, like, we need to some extent, we need to be careful with how we introduce people to hunting and how they're brought in and that they're taught to do things in a legal and ethical manner. Because, yeah, you know, so often it's really easy just to be like, oh, yeah, everyone needs to go hunting. Go get your hunter safety and get out in the woods. It's like that's a terrible idea for a lot of people.
100%.
I mean,
you've had no experience handling firearms or anything.
Yeah.
Or being in the woods. I mean, you freaking roll your ankle and break your ankle out in the middle of the woods and you literally have zero survival experience. You don't even understand basics of how to fix that. Like, you're in a pretty bad position right off the rip. And it happens all the time.
Or you got someone walking through the woods with a chambered round and the finger on the trigger and the safety off, and who knows?
Somebody's got a strutter on their head.
Oh dear heavens! I don't even want to talk about those things, man. I'm like, do what you will, man. Turkey hunting, you would never think it, but I swear, turkey hunting has to be like the most dangerous form of hunting there is. You can
Bubba Land turkey hunting is pretty aggressive.
I'm like, man, give me a trad bow and a grizzly bear before you send me public land turkey hunting.
I've been in North Georgia public land a good bit, and I have had people push in and cut me off on a bird gobbling that I had coming to me, and I just, you know, hey man, I can literally see you walking through the woods. I'm right here, you know, wave at them. There's, you know, wave back with one finger, you know, and I'm like, all right, here we go.
Oh my gosh. Turkey hunters are crazy people. I'll tell you, the people that are like, that's their thing. And trust me, and I say this because one of my best buddies, yeah, y'all are wild, man. One of my best buddies he's one of you crazy people, and I enjoy it. And I never thought I would enjoy it as much as I did.
Yep.
Or as I do. But man, y'all are a special breed. I gotta say, like, I don't know what it is.
I definitely know a major component of it is the interactivity, right? I mean, just like elk hunting, you call an animal response, the hunt, you know, in a sense is on. Right. Then you're trying to understand what are all the other variables that are in front of me. I mean, it's a chess match, right? Whitetail hunting is a lot of a chess match, but then it's a lot of just luck. You know, deer just has to, especially bow hunting, deer just got to decide that he's going to come that way that time. And you can increase your luck with a lot of preparation, but turkey hunting, man, they are just one day they go over here, one day they go over there, one day they gobble, one day they don't. I mean, it's just, there is no pattern, it seems. And so you're just looking at all these different variables. You're trying to understand, you know, what time of day it is, how much water, how much rain has there been, where are they going? Are they going to food? Are they going to water? Do they have hens? How many hens, you know, can you cut them off? Can you get, and it's just, it's run and gun. I mean, I love it.
Well, I'll tell you, the people listening probably heard me tell this story a bunch of times, but like my turkey hunting experience has been just the goofiest, like, shit show. To where, like, every, you know, I spent a couple of years, like, you know, going out, like 2 years going out and like fully camoed or in the blind and, you know, doing the calling and like the quote unquote proper way to turkey hunt. And I'll tell only two turkeys I've shot. I got, I guess it would have been last year. I got my two turkeys, spring season in California. One time I was wearing a pair of board short or a pair of gym shorts, some Crocs, I think I put on a t-shirt right after I shot them.
Yeah.
I just got word there were turkeys in the driveway. I went up, I knew exactly where they were going, 'cause I'd watched them several prior days, ran two properties over, posted up behind a tree and shot them. The other one, I was in a bright red shirt, a pair of board shorts and flip flops, and Elmer FUDded the hell out of that thing. But
well, you said something that's very important though. That's how you get successful at turkey hunting is by scouting and watching where they're going and watching what they're doing and spending time out there, because you knew where those birds are going. You get in front of them, you cut them off. That's kind of what I was saying earlier. Like if it's been really dry and you know that it's, you know, mid morning, they're off the hens and they're gobbling and they're not coming to you, but they're going towards a water source. Shut up, take, you know, run 100 yards backwards, run 100 yards to your left and run 200 yards down and try to get in front of them, and catch them coming there. Because I don't know, it's turkey hunting is either the easiest thing that you've ever done or it's impossible. You either sitting there, you're set up, you know, you got your setup, you're ready to go, you call a few times, bird flies down right in front of you, boom, game over. It's like, wow, well, that was pretty easy. But then the other 45 times that you go, they fly down the other way and they go the other way and they just don't even pay you any attention. They're just gobbling, just kind of walking around. You're like,
well, and I mean, you can again be doing everything right. But like you said, if you're not in the spot where the turkeys are, it's just not going to happen. But if you know exactly where the turkeys are going to be, you can get away with a lot more if they're feeding along and you're able to post up. But it's
for sure.
Yeah. I've had those experiences where my first year I could get every hen in a damn mile radius to come out to me.
Yeah.
And I'd get them to hang out and chill. And they didn't even give a crap about me. Like, it got to the point where it's so ridiculous. I'm like, all right, screw this. And I'd like stand up and go to move spots or something. They'd look at me and be like, and just keep going back to feeding.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you guys suck. And then
again, they're either the smartest animal out there or they're the dumbest. I don't know, it just depends what day it is. I don't really get that. But I mean, I've had birds, you know, have my trigger glove off, my trigger hand, and reach to grab a call or something. And immediately, you know, they're 65, 70 yards away and they just zone in like, right, like boom. You're like, oh God, I'm spotted. Mm-hmm. They take off. And I've had birds, you know, again, you know, no mask on, no gloves, no nothing, sitting there kind of giving up, you know, for the morning. And all of a sudden 10 yards behind you, they just sound off and they step right out. You just boom. It's like, wait, what, how did that happen?
But that was like one of my favorite moments. Was I'm out in my backyard. I'm shooting my bow. I'm just practicing for season, whatever. I can't remember. It was either like a month before or a month after turkey season. At that point, but I'm just out, you know, just out tuning my bow, and I kind of catch out of the corner of my eye, I see this movement. I'm like, oh dang, the chickens got out again.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, like, you know, I loose my shot and then I look and I'm like, holy shit, there's a couple of Jakes. There's like a whole, like, I swear there's probably like 10 or 12 turkeys just walked right in front of my target and like started feeding around in front of my target. And I'm like, sons of bitches.
Like, they know. Like, ah, you can't.
Every time.
I don't know.
Every time. Yeah. It was just like, and if I'd waited another second to release that arrow, they would have been walking right in front of it and I would have had to let down. Like, it was just the most.
But it's like, yeah, it's like in South Georgia, we plant a ton of peanuts, right? And so during the summer, it's an incredible source of nutrients for deer, high in protein and all that. And these deer walk out and just feed on it all afternoon. And you'll see these, you know, growing deer, but you can tell they're 4, 5, 6 year old. And, you know, they've only got, you know, 4 or 5 inches of velvet, but they're, you know, outside their shoulders, like, got 8, 10 points, you know, they're going to be monsters. And you watch them grow and you watch them grow and you watch them grow. And then about 3 weeks before the season, they just stop. They just stop coming out. And it's you know, they're there, you know, they're in the area. And they just disappear and you're like, and you just see them grow, you know, all the way from like little two forks to, you know, probably, especially with velvet, there's like, looks like it's a 200 inch deer. You're like, ah, you know, but anyways, yeah, it's, they know what's up. They know when people start poking around in the woods.
So man, hopping back to the hunter recruitment stuff, you know, you mentioned one of the big things for people is just take folks out, you know, and I know a lot of the time we're kind of talking about this beforehand. One of the critical things, honestly, for getting someone out there is two things. It's making it fun and making it successful and finding ways to do that. So say somebody's looking to bring someone out, like they've got a buddy that is interested in hunting or coworker or whatever. What are some of the critical things to keep in mind and maybe some suggestions for somebody that's taking someone out for the first time? Maybe it's their first time bringing someone with them even.
Yeah, for sure. You said two very important things, and that's kind of our minimum criteria for success, right? Is for everybody to have fun and for everybody to get success in the field. And we're at 100% success so far. Obviously, that probably won't stand, but it's been a great start. I would say that the most important thing is your attitude. And what I mean by that is, if you're not having fun and showing that you're not having fun, the person that's with you is not going to be having fun. If you show that you're having fun and, you know, when they're walking and stepping on every stick in the road that you don't turn around, like, hey, come on, man, be quiet. Like, you're just like, you know, hey, stop for a second here. You know, do you notice like when you're walking, you're stepping on these sticks, right? To someone that's never hunted, literally every little piece of information is new to them, right? So you can, you know, stop and say, hey, you know, look at that mushroom, you know, that's a morel, like you can eat that, it's delicious, you know, oh, watch out, you know, there's a snake or whatever, like that's poison ivy, don't step there. Hey, when you're walking, try not to walk in the leaves, walk in, you know, here. I mean, it's just like every little tiny thing, you know, this is a scrape, this is what the scrape means, this is what the deer do. They forget that they're not seeing animals at that point, right? They're just, first of all, they're just happy to be out there. And anytime you're outdoors, for me at least, it's an awesome experience. And so your attitude towards what's going on, and I think too, being honest up front, like if you're in a very low target environment, like you just don't have a lot of deer, mm-hmm. you know, I would say to the person that I'm taking, hey, you know, I've hunted 5 years in a row here. I've killed 3 deer. It's really difficult. But you've had some of the venison that I've shared with you, you know how rewarding it can be, et cetera, right? You just kind of preface them to not, you know, think that they're going to sit down and within 10 minutes, the deer is going to walk out and they're going to shoot it. But I think those two things, keeping it fun. And then one last thing, don't hunt too long, especially for younger people. You can't sit till lunchtime. Hour and a half to 2 hours is kind of, especially for younger people, hour and a half to 2 hours is kind of a max attention span. And new hunters are a lot like young kids, right? They haven't done it. They haven't experienced it. They haven't sat in a lock on in 0 degree weather with a 20 mile an hour wind for 4 or 5 hours, you know, mm-hmm. moving just enough to get something to eat and get something to drink. So, I would say those three things.
Well, it's so critical that you're able to read people too.
Like absolutely.
You're able to tell if somebody's engaged and understanding the situation, if you're sitting in a blind versus sitting in a tree stand in 0 degree weather and unable to move, yeah. you can probably get away with a little bit longer, say in a blind you can, or if you're walking through the woods and you know, it's your attitude. I don't think that's brought up enough is your attitude is so critical, like you were saying, because, you know, say you're sitting in a blind, you're hunting turkey with someone and the two of you are sitting there and you are just infuriated because you're in your primo spot with your buddy. You're like, yeah, dude, I'm going to show him how badass turkey hunting is because I'm a turkey crazy person.
Yep.
And I'm, you know, it's like, oh, this is my primo spot where, you know, I got some big old toms on the trail cams. This is going to be primo. And then all of a sudden,
100% success, 100% oh, yeah. chance of success.
Exactly. All of a sudden, all you're getting are like these like little teeny jakes and a couple of hens. And you're just like, what the hell is going on? And you're getting all irritated, but they're sitting there. They're like, they've never been turkey hunting.
Right.
They're like, holy crap, that bird just freaking came in. Like they're stoked on seeing a hen and you're like, what is this garbage the whole time? Or they're seeing a Jake there and you know, maybe the Jake fans up a little bit and they're like, holy shit, that's so cool. Yeah. And if you're not able to read that on them and you're sitting there getting irritated, they're going to, they're going to feel like they're missing out on something because you're not seeing those when in all reality, they're having the time of their life. And it's, that's such a critical thing. I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah. The only time that I show frustration in hunting with people are on decisions that I made for the hunt for them. And generally only reason why I'm even showing that I'm frustrated is to provide an educational component, right? Mm-hmm. Man, we really, dang, we shouldn't have sat here, you know, because I knew the wind wasn't going to be perfect. I knew that we should have done this. This is why we should have done this. Except, and the whole time they're going, okay, so we made a mistake. It's not that big of a deal. Like, this is why, this is what we need to do different next time. And you're just, and you're educating them. And again, people, someone that's never been hunting, I find a lot of times hasn't spent a ton of time just outdoors in general as well. And so there's an unending supply of things that you can talk about with the woods, right? What kind of bird is that? Why is that bird doing that? What kind of tree is that? What is the, you know, I mean, it's just like, all right, look at this field. You see how this field's laid out. You see where this ditch comes through. You see where this water source is. You see where this looks like a funnel. You see where this, you know, these peanuts are planted. And you just start talking about all the components of how the animals are going to move through the area. And you're just educating them constantly on hunting. And that's something that, you know, my dad, when I was little, always was educating us. Everything was a test, always, right? In a fun way. Like, it wasn't like a bad deal, but like when we were little and we would drive on his knee, he would tickle us while we were driving to make us focus on the driving, not on the tickling, to not, you know, to make sure we weren't worried about distractions mm-hmm. when we were driving, that we could retain focus. He would play a game when we'd be riding on the tractor for like 8 hours, you know, in the afternoon. Deer always came out in the field, even though if you're on a tractor. And every time that we spotted the deer before him, he would give us $50.
Damn.
Right. Okay. Because we never spotted the deer before him. You know, the only time we did, you know,
is he let us let you.
Yeah. He's like, oh, what's that over there? Like, well, there's a deer. You didn't see it. He's like, no, I didn't see it. You know, we would go into the woods and he would, you know, this is for cell phones or anything, right? We would go down deep in the woods. And he would say, all right, take us back to the truck, right? Always be aware of your surroundings. Always have situational awareness. Understand what's going on around you. That's a huge one. Situational awareness in the woods is kind of a major component when it comes to not getting injured or hurting yourself or getting lost or stuck out in the woods. And I got stuck out in the woods 2 years ago on a ridge because we were chasing elk and went down to this deep, dark hole. By the time we came out, it was dark and we couldn't find the trail out of there. It was a nightmare. It was an absolute nightmare. I knew better. You know, luckily we had enough stuff in our packs that it wasn't that big of a deal, except for we almost got charged by a grizzly bear, which was quite terrifying without any firearms. I'm downplaying a little bit. That's pretty terrifying. Definitely the closest I've ever been to a bear in public or in the wild. I've never hunted bear before. So it was, I think my heart's speeding up just thinking about it. My hands are sweating.
So I kind of want to pause for a second and hear this whole bear story right now. Like, I want to hear about it.
I guess it was two elk seasons ago. A buddy of mine, Caleb Copeland, he owns and runs Copeland Creative. They do a ton of outdoor digital content work. They're some of the best in the business, period. Based here in Georgia. And one of his guys, Ryer, and I were hunting elk. And we were in Idaho. It was the third year in a row I'd been to Idaho and struck out all three times. And we finally found the elk on day five. We had 6 days. We finally found them. And it was in the deepest, darkest, thickest, gnarliest stuff, to the point where we were within 40 yards of elk, probably, I don't know, 10 times, and just not even remotely a shot opportunity. Like, so you couldn't even see him. You see like a little brown patch, like move through the woods. You know, I'm sitting there clipped in with my bow, just like, just turn around, like, I don't know what I'm going to, I can't do anything right now. And then you're trying to back out and work around while they stay and call. So anyways, we play cat and mouse. basically from sunup to sundown. There was maybe an hour and a half where they weren't bugling. It was one of the coolest experiences I've ever had, aside from not shooting an elk. But we're sitting up on this ridge and sun's starting to get low. We know we've probably got about an hour left. And one just sounds off probably 150 yards below us. Another one, you know, another one. There's three bulls down there. You can hear stuff just going nuts. It's just stuff getting
turning
shredded.
Into war zone.
And we're like, it's on. Like, we don't even have to call because they're just going after it. So we start going down this face. And when I say deep, dark, and nasty, you could move like, 10 feet every 10 minutes. Like, it was just all of these deadfalls and just, terrible. But I'm pretty good shape. I'm going to get after it, you know, whatever. Well, of course, we get right there. You know, it's too dark. They flag off and run up this hill. We see these three bulls that are monsters. A guy killed one the next morning in that exact same area, sitting in the little little grass field at the base. That was a 7x6 monster, like 370, 380 or something like that. Anyways, we're like, damn, you know, that sucks. We got, you know, we got our maps, we got Onyx, we're cool. We get back up and we're like kind of halfway down the mountain and our trucks are there. Caleb rolls his ankle. So we're like, oh no, like now things have changed. So we know that going down that way is pretty bad. We had set a bike, an e-bike out on a trail off the back that was supposed to be just a super easy trail.
Okay.
We go to that trailhead on the map and we're sitting there down off this mountain and there's nothing. We can't find it. I bushwhack around for like an hour in the dark. It's so thick that I can't actually walk. I'm just like laying on top of bushes and stuff, like thinking that, hey, any second I'm just going to go off a cliff. So we back out and it's just too sketchy. We're like, man, it was very steep where we were. And, so we got one of those like, Sitka tarps, like, you know, whatever, we get that set up. We knew it was going to get cold that night. The good thing was we had perfect cell service. And, so we set this tarp up, wind starts kicking up real bad. We look at the forecast. Of course it goes from being like 40 that night to 21 or something like that with a 30-mile-an-hour wind. So we've been hiking all day. We basically got like base layer and like a mid layer in our pack and that's it. But we got this tarp. We get a little fire set up going. We're out of water. We don't have any food. We're just like, this is shitty. You know, this sucks. But, you know, it's part of it. Whatever. It's not that big of a deal. So we get like this good little spot. It's like kind of on the backside of this little outcropping so that the wind's kind of off of us. I lay the tarp down in the wind side, you know, all that stuff, little fire kind of inside the tent, retain some heat. It's not that bad. Well, after like an hour of sitting there, I hear Ryer over here just like crinkling in his backpack. And I'm like, what are you doing over here? You know? And then I literally just smell tuna. And I'm like, what up? I'm like, dude, you got food? Like, you're not sharing anything, not even thinking about like maybe fish during, you know, time that bears are coming out of hibernation. It's probably not the best thing to open with this type of wind. Cause it's just gonna, go
spread
everywhere.
Yeah.
It probably, and I'm not kidding, it was probably less than 10 minutes before you hear, and you just hear, and Ryer looks at me and goes, man, it's really weird that these elk are feeding up here at nighttime. And I go, bro, that's not an elk. I said, I don't know what that is, but it's not an elk. And so Caleb's asleep. So we wake him up and, you know, he's like, what? I'm like, I think there's a bear. He's like, ain't no bear, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, I'm pretty sure it's a bear. Never seen one in the wild, but I'm pretty sure it's a bear. And
I've watched a lot of YouTube videos and I'm
I've seen him at a distance, but never close. Yeah. And then you hear just the blowing and trying to clear his nose out and smell. And I was like, oh God. So we're like up on this little drop off So we can't see down, and no one, everyone's too scared to get up and look down this hill. But finally, it gets too close to the point where Ryer kind of sits up and shines his flashlight, immediately cuts it off and turns and goes, "Big bear, big bear, big bear, big bear." And we're like, "Oh God." So everybody stands up. I had this big pine bough that I took and just threw it on top of the fire and lit it on top of the fire and stood up with it. And everybody stood up and started clapping, started making all this noise. And he takes about 3 steps forward. And I swear to God, his head was like 2 feet wide. I mean, I saw his head and I went into adrenaline dump, like lockdown mode, like, oh my God, like pull my knife out. Like I'm going to do something with that. And I have an arrow in the other hand. We're just like yelling at this. And he just walks up and he kind of like turns his head and puts his shoulder to us. And from, you know, I don't really know, but that's usually a bad sign. And he starts circling us. And I'm thinking at any second, he's just going to step in and start swiping.
Yeah.
And he just circled about 45 degrees, kind of looked and just turned and walked off. We don't know where he went because we never heard him like bound off or anything. And we could hear him walking around. So needless to say, we didn't sleep at all that night. I think I slept like 40 minutes. But the next morning, we get up and we're walking down to the trail and we walk by what it was his den. You could see like clearly animal had been in and out of there. The trail went right by it. And, we get down to
how far away from that was your camp? The den to your camp.
Yeah. Oh, 4 yards maybe.
So like right there. Like,
oh yeah. It was on the other side of the outcropping.
I missed that part. Like, oh dear Lord. Okay.
Yeah. Jeez. Yeah. Yeah. And there was just a little path, like, cause it was like kind of it was almost vertical. I mean, it's probably like 80 degree, like down. And there was just a little path. You could see his tracks where he came out and walked around and, I will never forget any second of that. It was intense, but it was also pretty awesome. And then we get down, you know, we're like, oh God, we got to get something to eat. We got to get some breakfast. We go, we see the guy that kills that elk, like right down the mountain that next morning. I mean, probably, you know, we could see where he was from where we were, this monster, and he's in there eating breakfast. And we're just like, man, you gotta be shitting me. And then I pull up, like, you know, when you pull your phone up, Apple News pops up or something. I don't remember how I saw it, but a grizzly had attacked someone. And we didn't have we were not even really paying attention to anything all day. A grizzly had attacked someone that day, like less than 20 miles from where we were, north of us. And I was just like, oh my God. Like, oh, absolutely terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. But it was incredible. It was intense.
Oh man.
Don't want to do it again. Don't want to do it again, but it was intense.
Knock on wood. I've yet to have any bear encounters in the woods. Hopefully I will have one next time I go out bear hunting, but,
exactly.
I have not any grizzly encounters, but I'll tell you, when I was hunting in 2019 here in Montana, there was, like 7 grizzly attacks or something just stupid. There's like 5 or 7 of them. And it was just like one after another. And you just kept hearing about them. And my whole family is like sending me these articles. Like, are you okay? I'm like, yes, I'm fine.
What about the woman? Did you see that video on Instagram of that woman that goes in there and punches that bear in California?
Oh, the attacking one,
her dog.
It was like that kind of cinnamon looking. Like
swung.
Yeah, it's like that cinnamon looking brown bear hops up. It's got its cubs on the wall. And gosh, that is, that's been making its rounds. I was like, damn, I'm a little impressed.
I wouldn't do that. I'm sorry.
I do not think I would have had the balls to have done that. No. I mean, some women and their toy dogs, man.
I know. God.
I mean, that first one, like, what was like that big old dog. And then like, there's like 2 other like teeny little ones, like little toy dogs. And I was like, that little toy dog that you just hear grab and like pick up and run off with. I mean, man, California, Los Angeles women and their toy dogs. I'll tell you what. Oh man.
Yeah. Y'all have a lot of bear and cat encounters in California.
Don't so no more of that y'all stuff. I'm not included in that anymore. Anymore. Fair My enough. Driver's license says Montana on it. So okay. I'm no longer California.
Okay. Fair enough. Those Californians.
Exactly. You know, those people. What do you mean by those people?
Yeah. People that live in California. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Oh, dear Lord. It is. I mean, they just keep removing any ability to hunt predators out there. Like, I mean, they got rid of the bobcats. You can't hunt mountain lions. You can't bait bears or hunt them over or hunt them with dogs anymore. And, you know, there's no spring season for bears. I don't know. I've been told different things. I've been told by some people that we pretty much almost never reach our quota for bears every year. And then I've been told by a lot of people that they often would reach quota for bears. And I don't know how it is. Cause with the bear hunting, it's not a draw. You can, as long as you've got a license, you can buy a tag. They're not super expensive as a resident. And until the quota is reached, as many people as want effectively can hunt it. And I'm not sure. Let's just say I've never seen bear tags sell out in the time that I was a resident there. But the mountain lions get aggressive, the bears get it. It affects our ungulate populations. It's insane out there. It's absolutely insane.
Yeah, that's probably a whole other conversation for another day. But the whole predator prey relationship deal seems to be kind of misunderstood a little bit. But, you know, where I'm from, no one ever hunted bears. I never even knew that that was a thing.
Do you guys really have bear populations in Georgia?
Massive black bears in North Georgia. North Georgia, Northeast Georgia, Eastern Tennessee, Western Carolina, Western South Carolina. You've got like world record black bears because they don't hibernate and they're agriculture bears. So they eat corn all fall. They don't hibernate. So they eat all year round. And, you know, you've got it's 650, 700 pound black bears, like a good black bear. Like they're up in the 800s. And I don't know what the top end is, but they are massive black bears. My buddy lives in LJ and he's got a family that just like comes up in his backyard all the time. And he sees them. He's like, they see like 20 bears a week walking around. And we've actually got bears in South Georgia, specifically Southeast Georgia, Florida bears. And we had a piece of property, that had a couple bears on it. And, our new piece of property, we don't know if we have bears because we haven't been able to see the tracks, but our feeders keep getting knocked over and open. it is connected. There's about 40,000 contiguous acres from landowners, and a lot of that is kind of swampy, dense hunting land. So we haven't seen any tracks around it, so we don't really know. But my dad's like, I think you got a barn here to feed. I'm like, that'd be cool.
That'd be really cool.
Yeah, they've got them in Middle Georgia now too. Black bears, they're kind of growing.
Do they just not, hibernate just because of like it stays generally warm year round.
Yep.
So you don't get that really heavy.
Yeah. It gets, you know, North Georgia gets obviously a lot colder than South Georgia, but you know, you'll have probably a total of a week in kind of below freezing, in middle of North Georgia, maybe 2 weeks. South Georgia, you have a couple days that it gets below freezing. Our cold's definitely different because it's 100% humidity cold, and it's like 40 degrees outside and you're freezing to death. whereas out west, like 20 degrees and you got like a little fleece on, you're like, oh, it feels great. Just doesn't get cold enough. Like I said, it's massive agricultural, you know, all around all of Georgia, Tennessee, North Carolina, South Carolina, it's all agricultural. So these bears, the deer, everything, it's just like full blown. I would say it's like, you know what a Wisconsin or like a Kansas deer looks like compared to like an average whitetail.
Yeah.
It's the same as like an average black bear and these black bears. They're just like, swole up, like waddle around.
I'm going to start doing some black bear research for the South now, man. That's
Western North Carolina is a hot spot for big bears.
Huh.
And I was saying, like, I've never didn't know anyone that hunted bears, never thought about hunting bears. My dad and one of his buddies, I think, went on a grizzly hunt back in the 70s and had success there. His buddy did. But I, you know, it was just kind of, I never really thought about it. And then I ate bear. I don't know if you know who the Rivets are, John and Jen Rivet, out of Canada, like kind of preeminent bear people.
Yeah.
And she made some bear stew, and like absolutely unbelievably delicious. And I was like, man, just never even thought. And that like made this little switch go off my head. Like, wait, so I can kill one animal that's like massive and have all this meat for a long time, and it's really good, especially on like tacos and stuff, which I'm a big taco guy. And it kind of changed my whole opinion on this. And it's funny because that's a lot of the questions being in Atlanta. A lot of the questions I get, you know, anytime I put a post up or show, you know, killing an animal, people are like,
well, do you eat it?
Yeah. Well, I'm like, yes. Do you see any of the other stuff I put up? Cause a lot of the meat that I put up is either, you know, beef or venison or, you know, chicken or whatever. And, you know, it's always kind of a little bit of a realization for people when they seek to understand before seeking to be understood, right? When they start by asking questions instead of telling you what their opinions are on it. Mm-hmm. And for me, I think that's the only way that we have a useful conversation. But they say, well, you know, can you eat that? And I'm like, absolutely. Oh, yeah. And they're like, oh man, I don't think I could ever kill a bear. Like, you know, they're whatever. I'm like, okay, well, I thought the same way until I tried one and they're absolutely delicious.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I do a lot of meat sharing, here in Atlanta. That's another great way to recruit hunters, by the way.
Oh yeah.
Sharing venison. I mean, I have friends over all the time and I take back straps and sous vide with some, there's this guy called the Flip Flop Sauce out of California.
He's a good buddy of mine. He just moved to Bozeman. Yeah. Andy.
I didn't know Andy moved to Bozeman.
Yeah. Yeah. He's actually, I think got back into town yesterday. He's been out of town I'm supposed to sit down with him probably sometime next week. And we're going to lay down an episode, but yeah, he's been a buddy of mine for a long time.
He's awesome, dude.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what's in that magic sauce he makes, but it is, I mean, I've eaten venison my whole life. I've always liked it. Now it's like, all right, we got to ration out these back straps and these sirloins and this chuck, because like, if not, I'm just going to eat them all in a week, man. You sous vide in that sauce with a little bit of red wine for like 2 or 3 hours, and then literally just put it in a cast iron for 45 seconds on either side. It is the best.
That is the only way I do back straps. It does not matter what. In the sous vide with, you know, and make a little out of the drippings, make a little cream sauce or something, and then sear it. And that cat, dude, you're my soulmate here with this shit. Like, yeah. I mean, it's the only way I do it. Yeah.
I introduced my fiance. She'd never eaten deer. They'd never, you know, never hunted or anything. Mm-hmm. And now, like, I get home and I see my little, you know, little paper wrapped up, you know, whole back strap thawing out. And I'm like, what are you doing? She's like, well, I just want some tonight. I'm like, all right, cool. And it's a power meal, man. And so sharing that, and obviously, you know, if that's too technical, get some sausage made. I don't know anyone that doesn't like sausage.
Oh yeah.
And you feed people venison sausage and they're like, oh, okay. This clicks now. This makes sense.
I roll out with those cheddar jalapeno brats. That is like you could take garbage care of your deer in the field, and as long as you put turn them into cheddar jalapeno brats, everyone will gobble that stuff up. Like, absolutely. It is just, oh my gosh. Absolutely. I'll tell you though, I know a lot of people that swear by bear meat, a lot of people, over venison. And I'm talking like people that hunt bear regularly know how to take care of it, because it's a little tricky in the field because of the fat.
Yeah.
But the weirdest thing I've ever had that is incredible is just canned bear meat.
All right.
Like,
and you're not the first person I've heard say that.
Yeah. Ryan and Hillary Lampers. Yeah. In a jar. Ryan and Hillary Lampers, Stealthy Hunter here in Three Forks, Montana. They're the ones that introduced me to this, and it looks like dog food. You'll be like, it's like dog food and water is what it looks like.
Yep.
And it tastes absolutely incredible. And it's the best way to preserve it. It lasts forever. You jar it up in mason jars. And so like, look into that. I think they may have instructions for that. I'll have to look that up and see. But the canned bear meat is like the jam.
So I'll try anything once. And they had, I think the Rivets actually had some canned bear meat at that event that I was at where I ate bear the first time. And I think I remember seeing it and like kind of being like, I'm not really sure that's what I want. And then by the time I was like, yeah, I'll try it, it was gone because people were like freaking ravenous, like sucking it down. I was like, oh, well, damn. So what's the flavor profile? What is the,
It's been a while since I've had
it. Process. Like,
I do not trust myself to describe the process or everything. Yeah. I'm gonna look and see if I can find their like method for canning bear meat.
Yeah.
I'm sure they've done a podcast on it or something.
For sure.
They run the Hunt Harvest Health podcast. Cool, and you know, they're big into, you know, the locavore movement and wild game and growing their own vegetables and stuff. And it's something special. I know them and Brian Call have done some stuff on canning bear meat. So I'll have to find that. I'll post a link up on the show notes page. I'll shoot it over to you as well.
Okay, cool. Yeah. No, I that bear that I ate was just braised with, you know, deep flavor, like, you know, your mirepoix, celery, carrots, onions, and just put on a Traeger and cooked down. And it was, I mean, it's like pulled pork, except for pulled bear. That was phenomenal.
I'll have to send you the episode I did with Ryan recently, just at the beginning of bear season. Cause that's one of the things we talked about, a lot of the different ways to basically make bear super edible and things you can do with it. Ways to take care of it in the field. You'll probably get a kick out of that episode. And one of the cool things about bears with that fat, you can render it down in the field. And like, so, you know, you take your bear, you still maybe got an evening out, you know, as you're packing out. And it's one of the best meals you can have is you take that bear heart and you slice it up, you render down some of that fat, and that's like your dinner for the night. That's oh man.
Absolutely. Deer heart tacos are absolutely phenomenal.
I'm thinking I'm this weekend, I'm going to have to make some elk heart tacos for the young lady that's coming into town for a visit. So I think that is going to be the, I've got the back straps already marinating in the sous vide. But I've got them marinating in the fridge, ready to go for dinner tomorrow night. So going to throw those in the sous vide.
Absolutely.
Oh man. You're speaking my language here for that, but,
it's early for you, but it's almost lunch for me. I'm starting to get a little hungry.
I did not have breakfast this morning, and so I'm like, my mouth is watering thinking about it. Like, oh man, it's definitely going to be a wild game lunch today. I'll have to thaw out some. Maybe I'll do like a breakfast for lunch thing. I'll thaw out some of my breakfast sausage and do like some eggs, and that sounds like a good lunch to me.
Dude, one of my favorites is just take ground venison. Brown it with some onions, you know, salt, pepper, whatever seasonings you want. Put like in a skillet, and then put three little holes, drop your eggs in there, and then fold them in and cook it in that, just that bowl right there. It's like Action Jackson all up in your mouth. It's
nice.
It's super easy and delicious, and takes like, you know, 5 minutes to cook. So super healthy.
I think we're just killing ourselves right here with this.
I know. So, all right, new topic.
Oh man, yeah. So anything but discussing wild game cooking. I'm actually gonna start winding this down with a question here. You know, back to the hunter recruitment from the other perspective. Now, say you're somebody that you're like, man, I want to get into hunting, and like when I started, like I said, I was like in the middle of Los Angeles. I didn't have anyone to reach out to. I was finally lucky enough to meet a coworker who got me a little more invested, but, for the, a lot of people just don't have that option. And so say somebody does want to get in, like, they're like, man, I would love to be able to do something like that, to effectively get mentored. You know, what recommendations would you have for someone to go around that?
So a couple. First and foremost, you got to take what you got. And luckily nowadays, there are more resources online than there have ever been. And there's more stuff coming online every single day. I hunted a lot when I was little. Like I said, I rifle hunted a lot. And so I didn't understand a lot of the intricacies of whitetail hunting and turkey hunting. And, you know, 5 years ago, I just started watching YouTube. I just literally started watching everything, consuming all the information I could, try to figure out what are the common themes that everybody's saying, looking at, you know, the land that I hunt, how I can apply that to that land, talking with my dad, talking with people that I know that hunt, and really spending a lot of time trying to understand educational components before really putting myself out there. I want to make sure that I can be successful before I start trying to be a coach. Mm-hmm. You gotta be able to coach yourself before you really want to start trying to coach other people. And unfortunately, there are a lot of resources out there that are coaches that don't really know themselves. And so that's one kind of warning, is be careful with who you're paying attention to. But I mentioned his name before, John Dudley. If you're trying to hunt whitetails, obviously he's in Iowa. So those deer operate a certain way. Your area deer may operate a different way. But a lot of the information that he gives you can distill out basics in what he's doing and how to set up, you know, your stand, how to set up, what equipment to use, what to wear, when to hunt, looking at the moon, looking at the wind, looking at food, what all those different components. Just pay attention to all that stuff and start learning as much as you can. I would say it would not be a wise direction to try and ask somebody to go hunting if you haven't put in any work at all on the back end to understand anything about what you're getting into. I think it's kind of a cheap way to get into it. And it really puts a bad taste in people's mouths when you know, hey, I've never hunted before, don't know anything about it, can I come hunting with you? It's like, okay, well, how about this? You know, let's learn these basics before we go sit in a stand with a gun in our hands. Like I said, I mean, I did shoot my deer my first year when I was six, but I had to hunt, like, you know, 3 or 4 years with my dad, you know, and I can remember being 4 or 5 years old and seeing deer and be like, oh, dad, no, let me shoot one. And say, no, you know, not yet. Not until you're six. You know, that's a different experience. But, the beautiful thing about where we hold the Hunter Recruitment Project is there are a lot of like box blinds, right? So you have a lot of visibility. So you can see deer in all these different areas and you can watch them. You can watch how they move. You can watch what they do. You can watch their body language. And so you use all those opportunities as a way to educate the person sitting with you. And the first deer they see, they're reaching for their gun. And it's like, well, hold on, that deer's 500 yards away. We're probably not going to attempt that shot right here. But that would be the biggest thing is make yourself at least aware of concepts. Make yourself aware of, you know, where to shoot a deer, how to use your weapon, how to use your bow. You know, get yourself some gear that can sustain you when you're hunting. Obviously, you know, you don't got to have top of the line stuff. I mean, I hunted literally my whole life with like duck boots, which only keep your feet hot when it's hot and keep them cold when it's cold. And like, you know, blue jeans and like a camouflage fleece. I mean, that's basically, I mean, up until, you know, some of these new companies have come out in the last kind of 10 years, that's all there was. There just wasn't a lot of stuff. I mean, wool, he wore a lot of wool, yeah. But, you know, I think that if you're going to dedicate yourself to taking the life of an animal, you need to be damn serious about it. And you can't be flippant and you can't, you know, come in without really putting your focus towards it, or it's somewhat disrespectful in my opinion. And I'd say that that's kind of from the opposite side, you know, prepare yourself. I mean, it's just like any other thing that you're going to do, right? I mean, if you're going to run a, you know, participate in a triathlon, you probably ought to practice. You probably ought to learn how to ride the bike. You probably ought to learn how to, you know, provide yourself with the proper nutrition, learn how to swim, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to go out in the woods in a very dangerous sport, right? People don't think deer hunting, sitting in a stand with a rifle is very dangerous. You're not going to know the ins and outs of everything, but take the time to focus on learning before you put yourself in that situation.
Awesome. Well, man, I really appreciate you on such short notice joining me and hopping on. This was a fun conversation. Had a good time.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the opportunity. It's a great conversation. Nice break to a Wednesday. Get to actually talk about something that I'm super passionate about.
There we go. All right, y'all, that'll do it for this episode of The Wild Initiative. Make sure to check out the show notes page at thewildinitiative.com. Get links to everything we talked about in today's episode. Big thank you to Jamie for hopping on with me on such short notice. Got a pretty busy week coming up, so was glad we were able to get some time in. Make sure you check out the Hunter Recruitment Project, y'all. And make sure maybe this year, find an opportunity to introduce someone to the outdoors, introduce someone to hunting, fishing, whatever that may be. Reach out to your friends that have shown interest and take that time to get someone new into the outdoors. But y'all, that'll do it for this week. Looking forward to next time. But until then, I hope this podcast inspired you to get involved, get outdoors, and plan your initiative for the wild.
Thank you for listening to The Wild Initiative. Please take a moment to leave a rating and review on iTunes or Stitcher. And head on over to thewildinitiative.com to get show notes, check out the blog, gear discounts, other podcasts from the Wild Initiative family, and more.